it's a real possibility that other charges could stem as a result of that investigation.
Alaska State Troopers continue investigating one of their own. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Bureau of Land Management releases a summary of responses to the proposed Ambler Road.
Comments from the mining industry, comments from environmental groups, a lot of comments from the tribes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Department of Public Safety continues to investigate after prosecutors filed felony charges yesterday against an Alaska State Trooper accused of attempted sexual abuse of a minor. But as of today, 57-year-old Vance Peranto is no longer a trooper. The agency fired the 16-year veteran of the force this morning. He had been based in Soldotna. According to the charges, Peranto struck up an online relationship with a 16-year-old girl after a traffic stop several weeks ago. The charges say their conversations became sexually explicit and included nude photos. The girl's father discovered the messages and reported them to authorities Thursday, kicking off an investigation that culminated in a sting operation in Anchorage on Sunday. The charges say Peranto arrived at a hotel in his patrol vehicle, hoping to meet the girl in her room. Instead, he found other troopers behind the door, and they arrested him. Major Andrew Greenstreet, deputy director of the troopers, says there were many troubling aspects to the case.
You get kind of a sinking feeling that something like this could be going on. These, you know, types of cases where we investigate our own come up from time to time. And we act on them very swiftly and deliberately.
A Department of Public Safety spokesperson says the case has prompted further investigation of Peranto's past interactions with other members of the public. Greenstreet says the Alaska Bureau of Investigation is conducting a thorough review and taking any other complaints seriously.
It's a real possibility that other charges could stem as a result of that investigation.
Jail records show Peranto remains behind bars. A judge has ordered him held on $10,000 cash bail. Peranto previously appeared in news reporting earlier this year in relation to a lawsuit in which he was accused of sexual harassment for allegedly sending disturbing text messages to a state prosecutor's personal cell phone. Officials with the Troopers and Department of Public Safety refused to comment on whether Peranto faced any review or reprimand related to that case. First Quantum Minerals and Northern Dynasty announced today another delay in finalizing their option agreement. Northern Dynasty Minerals is the sole owner of the Pebble Limited Partnership. In December, the parties announced that First Quantum had agreed to buy into Pebble at $150 million over 4 years. At the end of those 4 years, First Quantum would have the option to become a 50% owner of PLP. The original framework agreement gave the companies until April 6th to finalize the deal. After the December announcement, Pebble Limited Partnership CEO Tom Collier said the initial $150 million would help fund the permitting phase of the proposed mine in Bristol Bay. Last month, the companies extended the deadline to finalize the agreement to April 30th. They've now extended it a second time. The new deadline is May 31st. An analysis by state officials finds that requiring people who receive Medicaid to work won't save the state government money. That's because the state would have to pay people to help residents find work and to check that they're complying with the requirement. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on what lawmakers say in response.
President Donald Trump's administration is encouraging states to require people to work if they benefit from Medicaid or other low-income programs. Senate Bill 193 seeks to do this by requiring Medicaid recipients to seek work or job training, volunteer, engage in subsistence activities, or provide caregiving. The requirements would apply to adult Medicaid recipients who are younger than 65, who do not have disabilities, and who aren't being treated for substance abuse. The State Department of Health and Social Services says the state would need to hire workers to ensure the state meets federal requirements. Deputy Health and Social Services Commissioner John Sherwood says federal officials set a high bar for states to meet, in part because the work requirements will face legal challenges.
Their policy was written with defending litigation around this issue in mind, so there are a lot of requirements imposed upon states who move forward to ensure that the individuals subject to these requirements have adequate protection.
To do this, the department proposed hiring 49 people. The expense from the added positions, along with other costs to help people find work, means the department estimates the added requirement would cost nearly $14 million per year. Even if the state could cut most of the proposed expenses from the bill, its costs would still exceed its savings, because most of the savings would go to the federal government, which funds the bulk of Medicaid costs for those affected. Senators pressed Sherwood on why the department didn't expect more savings for the state. He defended the approach.
We do our best to come up with what we think are reasonable assumptions and avoid making highly speculative guesses.
Sherwood notes that the constant monitoring of whether Medicaid recipients are complying with requirements would be more expensive than other social programs. Republican Senators Anna McKinnon of Eagle River and Peter Michicki of Soldotna support eliminating the 49 proposed positions. They argue that private contractors or the Department of Labor and Workforce Development could do the work, but they want more information about how that would work. Michicki says there must be a way to not add department costs.
The organization is a bureaucracy that does things a certain way. Most of it's born in D.C., and we inherit it. And that's the problem, is it does things a certain way. And that certain way isn't working.
Due to the various health and age exemptions, the bill would only affect 25,000 Alaskans, roughly 1 in 10 people who receive Medicaid. The Senate Finance Committee discussed the measure Tuesday. The committee plans to bring the bill up again Wednesday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The Bureau of Land Management received thousands of public comments on the controversial Ambler Road project. The BLM released a summary of those comments this week. The road proposed by the state would begin at the Dalton Highway and run more than 200 miles west along the southern edge of the Brooks Range. Proponents say it's needed to develop the Ambler Mining District. Tim Lamar with the BLM says the agency received input from people on all sides of the issue.
I was impressed with the range of comments that we got. Comments from the mining industry, comments from environmental groups, a lot of comments from the tribes.
Some of those comments argue the road will lead to job growth and economic benefits for the state. Others raise concerns that it would disrupt the Western Arctic caribou herd's migration or enable more drugs and alcohol to enter rural communities. A topic that came up often in the comments was who would have access to the road. The state says the road will only be permitted for non-public industrial use. But a number of commenters questioned the state's ability to keep the road closed to the public, especially over the long term.
A lot of those comments stem from the concern that if it's opened up to public use, then that opens up a huge area in Alaska that, you know, sport hunters and fishermen can start to use those resources at the expense of subsistence uses.
The comments will help the agency develop an environmental impact assessment for the project. That assessment will underpin BLM's decision on whether to allow the road to be built on federal land. The Justice Department has decided not to seek the death penalty against an Alaska man accused of killing 5 people and wounding 6 in a Florida airport shooting. Officials say 28-year-old Esteban Santiago of Anchorage will agree to a life sentence. The announcement was made in Miami today. Santiago pleaded not guilty to a 22-count indictment in the January 2017 shooting in a baggage claim area at Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. Authorities say he got a handgun from checked luggage, loaded it in a bathroom, and came out firing. Since his arrest, Santiago has been treated at the Miami jail for schizophrenia. He complained of mental health problems before the shooting, but was not barred from possessing a gun. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how a Hooper Bay community is coming together to recover from tragedy.
Even I was having body ache, I just danced. I got healed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
Relocating the Newtok School into the temporary building at Matarvik will be delayed until the fall of 2019. What's the holdup? The Newtok Village Council informed the Lower Kuskokwim School District that the problem is a lack of housing. KYUK's Christine Trudeau has more.
The district hoped they'd be able to make the move this summer, but now it looks to be over a year away. LKSD Assistant Superintendent Carlton Kuhn said housing for families won't be available this fall, so the kids would not be at Muktukovik to be taught. Kuhn said, quote, "It is going to happen. There is vertical construction happening over there. Managing the funding sources the tribal council has got to be incredibly difficult." That's with funds coming from 3 or 4 different federal and state agencies. Superintendent Dan Walker also told the LKSD board that he's concerned about teachers getting stranded without housing at the new village site. Walker told the board the district's lobbyist has been in touch with YK Delta legislative representatives and Lieutenant Governor Byron Milot, who told him they aim to have $400,000 budgeted specifically for teacher housing at Muktukovik. Walker added that the district is trying to get one of the retrofitted military barracks being barged in from Anchorage for village housing set aside for teacher housing, but that won't happen until 2019. Walker said the district is also seeking funds from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. In Bethel, I'm Christine Trudeau.
The Army says a 22-year-old soldier assigned to an Alaska post has died in Afghanistan. Specialist Gabriel David Condi was killed Monday by enemy small arms fire in Tagab District. Condi enlisted in August 2015 in Loveland, Colorado. He was assigned in April 2016 to U.S. Army Alaska and stationed at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Condi was an airborne infantryman in the 3rd Battalion, 509th Infantry Regiment, 4th Infantry Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division. He and his brigade were deployed to Afghanistan in September of 2017. Army Corps of Engineers officials were at Fort Greely last week to begin planning in earnest for the decommissioning and possible dismantling of the old mothballed nuclear power plant on post. The staff from the Corps' Baltimore office also are talking with officials on post and in Delta Junction about the project, which could take up to a decade to complete. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Decommissioning a nuclear power plant is a complex undertaking under the best of circumstances. Even more so when the plant is located in the same building as the facility that provides heat and backup power to Fort Greely.
We have to work very closely with the installation as well as with the privatized utility to make sure that we're not interfering with their ability to provide utilities to the installation and the mission. But we also need to make sure that we can achieve our mission.
Project manager Brenda Barber says isolating and removing some or all of the old SM-1A components from the area next to the steam heat facility, which the nuke plant once powered, is one of the thornier problems that will have to be overcome during the decommissioning project.
There will be a lot of complicated decisions that need to be made, a lot of collaboration that's going to be required. and trying to separate those two systems, which were originally designed to be together.
The Army hooked up diesel-fired boilers to the post's district heating system after it shut down the SM-1A in 1972. A few years ago, the Army privatized the steam heat plant, and it's now operated by Doyon Utilities. So the project will have to include provisions to ensure the safety of the steam heat plant workers as they keep it operating while work is underway on the SM-1A.
Our key point is going to be health and safety of both, you know, the occupational workers for our staff as well as the staff on the installation and the public as a whole.
Hans Honerlaw is a health physicist with the Corps, and he says an important part of the preliminary planning now underway includes determining how much of the SM-1A can be safely removed without creating a risk to human health from exposure to radiation.
The goal is for it to be out of here, and the goal is to reduce the risk. Now, could I say every atom's going to be gone? No, we're going to reduce the risk to a level that is going to be more acceptable.
Barber says the decommissioning plan that's now being developed will address those complexities. She expects that plan to be completed in 2021, and she says the Corps hopes to begin soliciting for a project contractor the following year. She estimates the project will be done in 2027, but she couldn't estimate how much the project will cost because there are so many unknowns. She says a project to decommission a similar nuclear power plant was estimated to cost $34.6 million.
Unfortunately, the challenges and the complexity of that work, that contract price doubled, and that contract is sitting at $66.4 million right now, and we're hopeful we can finish for that.
Barber says the Corps has begun market research on potential contractors capable of doing the main project and others to do subcontract work and other possible projects that may be done separately, such as construction of a man camp to accommodate workers.
It allows us to understand if there are Native Alaskan companies, if there are what we call 8A companies, small business. We will look for opportunities where smaller businesses could take advantage of finite pieces of the work.
Barber says the project also will include designating the SM-1A an historic property. She says artifacts that were buried with the reactor in 1973 will be returned to post officials, and she says the federal government will work with the Alaska State Historic Preservation Office to help preserve the story of the SM-1A, Alaska's first and so far only nuclear power plant. At Fort Greely, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
About 6 years ago, community members in Hooper Bay worked together to revive a Yupik dance group for young people. The idea was to help connect kids to their culture, teach about the effects of alcohol and drugs, and prevent suicide. And it has worked, but not with every kid. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman traveled to Hooper Bay and learned about the healing power of dancing, even after a tragedy.
A group of about 15 young people gather at the Youth and Elders Building in Hooper Bay in late winter for dance practice. It's their first meeting in a while, in part because one of their members died by suicide a few months before. Memorials to the young man named Patrick decorate the walls. There's a psalm that's dedicated to him, and a banner covered in handprints and notes saying how he helped everyone and had a wonderful laugh. The dance group starts the practice with his favorite song. His friend, Gideon Green, says practice isn't the same without him.
He was my right-hand man. Like, if he was still here, you know, the voice. Our voices would have been louder. It would have been louder. It would have been more funner. I almost didn't want to come back to the group after what happened. But then it just, you know, like something told me to.
Gideon is a leader in the dance group and one of the main singers. He and Patrick were some of the first kids to join about 6 years ago. Community members started the group after a couple of local people died by suicide to help support the youth and to give them hope and something to do. And when you talk to people around town, they say it has helped a lot. One young woman said it stopped her from misbehaving and spending too much time with TV and video games. Now, she teaches the little ones to dance and sew. Gideon passes on the songs he learned from the elders and teaches the boys to drum. He says drumming helps him relax.
It releases stress, you know, it makes you feel better.
And that's part of the reason why people dance. There's an adult dance group in town as well as the youth group. Hoover Bay elder and dance leader Margie Bell participates in both. She explains through a story that dancing heals. One Sunday, her body was aching, but she went to dance practice anyhow, not intending to participate.
While they were dancing, the elders told them, come on, we don't know some of the song. We need you. So even I was having body ache, I just danced. I got healed.
Margie says it's not just the physical movements and the connections with history that help. She says dancing is nourishing because people are together to share their feelings and talk through what's troubling them. She says over the past 6 years, she's seen changes in some of the young people.
Through dancing, Eskimo dancing, we could see the difference. They're more lively and more willing and really pushing.
But that doesn't mean it's a cure-all. Being in a dance group won't fix everything. Adolescence, life, suicide, they're complicated. But it provides support that keeps young people, like Gideon, coming back. And on the days he doesn't feel up to it, well, he doesn't really have a choice.
Because if I don't come, my phone's gonna be crazy. They're gonna be like, come to practice, we need you. Hurry up and get up here. Like, where are you? They'll start texting me like crazy.
Gideon misses his friend. They grew up together. They drummed together. He's coming to accept that his friend has passed.
But, you know, things happen for a reason. I know he's here with us, watching us, laughing at us, smiling at us, you know.
And with that, he and the other young men start singing another song. If you or someone you know is thinking about suicide, you can call Alaska's Care Line at 1-877-266-4357. It's okay to ask for help. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Although it's bright yellow, not many people have seen Anchorage's municipal flag. It's only flown in a few spots around the city, but as Alaska Public Media's Victoria Peterson reports, it's full of symbolism.
At Anchorage's public library, the geese are returning from winter and people are shuffling in and out of the newly renovated building. Abigail Ash comes here 2 to 3 times a week, always passing by the library's 3 large flagpoles.
I noticed the flag, but I just didn't know what it stood for. I always saw my daughters even and come in here and you're like, what's that? I was like, I have no clue.
Ash is referring to the municipal flag, which flies next to the U.S. flag and the state flag at the library. Most people don't notice it or know what it stands for. Don Bergman also frequents the library about twice a week.
I look at the flags, all 3 of them, and occasionally I notice they're at half mast and I'm curious about why. I never noticed it was the city flag. Now that I know that, I'll appreciate it.
The library and museum are among the few places in Anchorage where you can see the flag flying in the wind. Both Bergman and Ash agree that Anchorage needs a city flag and that they'd like to see it around more.
Oh yeah, sure, we need a flag.
It stands for us, of course.
The flag features the municipal seal, designed with Captain Cook's ship, the Resolution, a nod to the explorer's history with Anchorage. It has a large anchor in a small airplane to symbolize Anchorage as a port and as the air crossroads of the world. The seal sits on a field of bright yellow, and the words Anchorage, Alaska adorn the top and the bottom of the seal. Ted Kay is a vexillologist, which means he studies the design of flags. Kay lives in Portland and is the secretary for the North American Vexillological Association. He says poorly designed flags are flown less, which may explain why few Anchorage residents recognize their own flag.
I like to say that in every bad flag design, there's a good flag design trying to get out. And Anchorage's flag is no exception. It has great imagery. An anchor for Anchorage is just super. But writing the words Anchorage, Alaska on the flag, in a sense, shows that Anchorage is insecure about its symbolism.
Kay has written numerous books about flag design, including one about the history and design of 150 different city flags across the nation. He says his researchers found nearly nothing when gathering information about Anchorage's flag.
We know what the design represents, but we didn't know who had designed it or exactly when. That was just not available to our researchers when we contacted Anchorage.
After reaching out to the museum, the mayor's office, and the library, it was discovered that Anchorage artist Joan Kimura was the original designer. A longtime artist in Anchorage, Kimura taught art at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and formerly the Anchorage Community College, from 1973 to 1994. The UAA Kimura Art Gallery is named in her family's honor. Kimura submitted an acrylic painting of her flag design for a contest the city was having in 1973. It's almost exactly the same as the flag flying at the museum and the library today. Thorne Bay, Wrangell, Wasilla, Homer, Houston, and Ketchikan are a handful of other cities in Alaska that have official flags. North Pole features Santa Claus in their flag, while Seward's flag was chosen in 2016 from a contest that featured art from over 350 school children. Some might ask why a city flag is important. Kay says flags can be used for people to identify with and to rally around.
City flags look both inward and outward. Inward, they create a sense of identity to tie the residents together and help define who they are. Outward, a flag creates a brand to represent the city to the outside world.
Residents see the municipal seal everywhere, from liquor licenses to ballots to the sides of municipal vehicles. However, spotting it flying is far rarer. In Anchorage, I'm Victoria Peterson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove and Victoria Peterson in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Ravenna Koenig and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Christine Trudeau in Bethel, and Ann Hillman in Hooper Bay. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Alaska Native Village Corporation Association's 10th Annual Conference and Board Meeting is May 10th and 11th in Anchorage at the Egan Center. Learn about new developments and opportunities from Alaska's business leaders, network with Alaska Native Corporation executives, and hear from the nation's top figures in Native contracting and small business. Agenda and registration at anvca.biz. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.